Following are comments on William Shakespeare's The Two Noble Kinsmen, Prologue and Act I. New plays and maidenheads are near akin. The prologue speaker makes a novel comparison between good plays and maidenheads, and expresses anxiety about the current play's ability to do justice to its great source, Chaucer's The Knight's Tale. The prologue speaker compares the initial rolling out of a play to the experience of a virgin giving up her maidenhead's intact state. The idea is that if a play is good, there's no loss in the experience of it. So too does chastity, female honor, survive the wedding night with no harm done and more enjoyment ahead. In a sense, then, while the play's subject involves different kinds of romantic excess, the authors themselves take a practical, even business-like view of sexual experience. The prologue speaker also admits to some anxiety about the company's ability to do justice to the source of the two noble kinsmen, Chaucer's The Knight's Tale. This anxiety does not run very deep, though, since a little audience applause will provide the necessary wind for a successful, quote-unquote, tack by the players, allowing them to stage an entertaining story of some 2 hours' length. Prologue, line 26. Our lords lie blistering for the visitating sun. Theseus and Hippolyta's wedding procession grinds to a halt when three queens kneel and seek Theseus's support for the burial of their dead husbands, who, for warring against the Theban king Creon, remain unburied. Hippolyta and Emilia add their voices to persuade Theseus to undertake this holy errand without delay. As we can see from the outset of Act I, Scene I, the sway of ritual is a major interest of Shakespeare and John Fletcher in The Two Noble Kinsmen. Under the watchful eye of Hymen, the god of marriage, Duke Theseus of Athens enters, followed by the conquered Amazon queen, Hippolyta, chaperoned by a nymph, quote-unquote, holding a garland over her head. A boy sings a song paying tribute to flowers and herbs and just the right kinds of birds, ones that qualify as, quote-unquote, bird melodious or bird fair. Act 1, Scene 1, line 17. But then three queens dressed and veiled in black kneel in front of Theseus, then Hippolyta, and finally Hippolyta's sister, Emilia. We now have a funereal spectacle, three participants in ritual lamentation interrupting a joyous wedding procession. Theseus asks the first queen to speak for the rest, and she explains that she and the others want him to overcome, quote-unquote, the wrath of cruel Creon that still manifests itself in impiety, even after his Theban forces have won their battle against invaders. Act 1, Scene 1, line 40. Creon has, she explains, refused proper burial to their husbands. Theseus recognizes the first queen as Evadne, widow of King Carpanius of Argos, one of the famous Seven Against Thebes. He pays tribute to her long-lost beauty and laments the wasting passage of time, exclaiming, quote-unquote, O grief and time, fearful consumers, you will all devour. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 69 through 70. Theseus is evidently moved by Evadne's tale of woe. Then the second queen makes her plea to Hippolyta, recognizing her prowess in battle, but at the same time acknowledging the gender regime that has prevailed for most of human history. She says to Hippolyta, quote-unquote, insert, thou wast near to make the male to thy sex captive, but that this thy lord, born to uphold creation in that honor first nature styled it in, shrunk thee into the bound thou wast overflowing. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 80 through 84. The second queen asks Hippolyta to add her strong female voice to the widow's pleas, and Hippolyta promises to speak with Theseus. Then comes the third queen's turn. She addresses Hippolyta's sister, Emilia, and has no trouble convincing her to add her pleas to the cause. Theseus, though himself moved by the queen's wretchedness, is for the moment strongly inclined to carry on with his and Hippolyta's wedding. This brings on a desperate protest from all three queens, with outrage-laden language such as, quote-unquote, "Our lords lie blistering for the visitating sun." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 145 through 146. This additional triplicate of pleading drives Theseus to make a bigger concession, and he orders Artesius to put together a military force appropriate to the mission he must undertake. All the same, he still seems determined to go ahead with his wedding rites, which he calls, quote-unquote, "this grand act of our life, this daring deed of fate in wedlock." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 164 through 165. As we might have expected, Theseus's persistence does not satisfy the widows. They continue to complain, and the first queen insists that once Theseus enjoys making love to Hippolyta on his wedding night, he will forget about the sacred mission to which they have enjoined him. Quote unquote, "Oh, when her twining cherries shall their sweetness fall upon thy tasteful lips, what wilt thou think of rotten kings or blubbered queens?" Act 1, Scene 1, lines 177 through 180. Hippolyta steps up and pleads for the widows, saying that if she doesn't, quote unquote, "I should pluck all ladies' scandal on me." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 191 through 192. We know that the Amazon queen is only Theseus's bride-to-be because she and her tribe were conquered in war, so the three queens' cause has now been enlisted in a gender-based power game. Hippolyta is suggesting that she should have some influence with her lordly husband, else he does not respect her, or women generally. Emilia adds that she will remain part of Diana's virgin cult rather than allow such an offense as slighting the three queens. All this is too much for Theseus, and he gives in, saying, quote unquote, "I am entreating of myself to do that which you kneel to have me." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 206 through 207. He assigns his friend, Pirithous, to make sure that the celebration in Athens will proceed smoothly without him. Theseus's excellent summation of his reasoning at this point is, quote unquote, "As we are men, thus should we do. Being sensually subdued, we lose our human title." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 231 through 233. Here, Theseus reaffirms the hierarchy of reason and duty over sensuality. Palamon and Arcite, as we will soon find out, do not act in such a felicitous manner, and their surrender to passion is what creates the genuine drama in this play. They will be only partially protected by the fineness of their chivalric ideals. Our services stand now for Thebes, not Creon. Palamon and Arcite, nephews of King Creon, discuss leaving their corrupt native city, Thebes. Word comes that Duke Theseus of Athens is marching against Thebes and seems already to have arrived there, so the two cousins decide that they must defend their city, Creon notwithstanding. In Act 1, Scene 2, Palamon and Arcite, nephews to the dishonorable King of Thebes, hash out the difficulties that come with living in a corrupt state. Arcite's comment is incisive. Quote unquote, "Here to keep in abstinence we shame, as in incontinence, for not to swim in the aid of the current were almost to sink." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 6 through 8. As the Norton editor explains, Arcite's meaning is that to remain uncorrupted in a corrupt land is as disadvantageous as behaving corruptly in an uncorrupted one. Palamon adds to this thought the observation that he sees all around him the shabbily dressed and wretched soldiers who fought for Thebes and now are betrayed by their city and ignored. Why stay in a place that treats its defenders that way? In such a state, says Palamon, a new war might actually function as a purifying element. Would that Juno, long an opponent of Thebes, might, quote-unquote, resume her ancient fit of jealousy to get the soldier work that peace might purge for her repletion and retain anew her charitable heart. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 22 through 25. Cousin Palamon's continued takedown of Thebes and Creon sounds much like many a rant about the corruption of rulers and countries down to Shakespeare's time, in condemning foppish men who show themselves slaves to corrupt fashion, he says, quote-unquote, "'Tis in our power. Ellipsis, to be masters of our manners. And, quote-unquote, "'Why am I bound by any generous bond to follow him, follows his tailor, haply so long until the followed make pursuit?' Act 1, Scene 2, lines 42 through 44 and 49 through 52. Why go broke, as the Norton editor glosses these lines, trying to keep up with the silly fashions of the times? Of the effect of Creon's corruption-based leadership style, Palamon says that his uncle's, quote-unquote, successes makes heaven unfeared and villainy assured. Beyond its power, there's nothing. And, quote-unquote, deifies alone voluble chance. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 63 through 67. Readers of Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida may remember Ulysses' figure in Act 1, Scene 3, for what happens when leaders despise good order. Quote unquote, take but degree away, untune that string, and hark what discord follows. Under the corrupt and tyrannical ruler Creon, once great Thebes has become impossible to live in. Just when both cousins are ready to depart from Thebes, Arcite even says, quote-unquote, let's leave his court that we may nothing share of his loud infamy. Valerius arrives with a message that they've been summoned by Creon, who is in a rage at the news of Theseus's approach. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 75 through 76. This news puts an end to Palamon and Arcite's talk of leaving their native land behind. Quote unquote, our services stand now for Thebes, not Creon, says Palamon, and Arcite agrees. Act 1, Scene 2, line 99. They may feel no loyalty towards Creon, but their chivalric honor demands loyalty, at least, to their city. What she liked was then of me approved, what not, condemned. Pirithous leaves Athens to fight in Thebes. Hippolyta and her sister Emilia laud the unbreakable bond of friendship between Theseus and Pirithous, and Emilia tells Hippolyta about her own close ties with a girl named Flavina. In Act 1, Scene 3, Hippolyta blesses the departure of Pirithous to Athens, where Theseus has gone. She is aware of the close friendship, the amicitia, between these two men, but it does not seem as if she considers it a threat to her relationship with Theseus. She speaks with martial toughness to her husband's close friend, reminding him that she and Emilia, quote-unquote, have been soldiers, and proclaiming herself tearless even to mention, quote-unquote, women that have sawed, that is, boiled, their infants in and after ate them the brine they wept at killing him. Act 1, Scene 3, line 18, and lines 20 through 22. Emilia observes the now departed Pirithous, quote-unquote, how his longing follows his friend. Hippolyta adds mention of the many hardships the two men have been through together, and declares, quote-unquote, they're not of love, tied, weaved, and tangled with so true, so long, and with a finger of so deep a cunning, may be outworn, never undone. Act 1, Scene 3, lines 41 through 44. She is not sure, she says, whether Theseus loves Pirithous more or her. Emilia then reminisces about a blissful period of pre-adolescent love with a girl, now dead, named Flavina. Of this girl, she says, quote-unquote, What she liked was then of me approved, what not condemned. Act 1, Scene 3, lines 64 through 65. The two were practically one, and the passage sounds a little like the lovely description Milton in Book 4 of Paradise Lost would later give of innocent Eve gazing at her own image in a pool of water, like Narcissus. Quote unquote, "What thou seest, what there thou seest, fair creature, is thyself. With thee it came and goes." Here, though, Shakespeare and Fletcher are not alluding to anything insubstantial or any mildly pejorative narcissism. Emilia affirms the reality of this love when she says, quote unquote, "The true love between maid and maid may be more than in sex individual." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 81 through 82. Hippolyta correctly parses Emilia's recounting of this love as no more than a shaky insistence that she, quote unquote, "shall never, like the maid Flavina, love any that's called man." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 84 through 85. Emilia may think she can remain a devotee of the cult of the virgin goddess Diana, but Hippolyta is not convinced. She does believe, however, that when it comes to Theseus, she, and not Pirithous, can rightly claim to, quote unquote, "possess the high throne in his heart." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 95 through 96. Their lives concern us much more than Thebes is worth. Theseus defeats Creon in battle, then bids goodbye to the widowed queens, telling them to gather up their husband's remains. The wounded Palamon and Arcite are carried in, and Theseus orders that the best doctors should treat their injuries. He means to imprison the two cousins. In Act 1, Scene 4, Theseus emerges as the victor in the battle against Creon at Thebes, and at the city's outskirts, the three widowed queens kneel and praise him. He tells them to, quote unquote, "go and find out the bones of your dead lords and honor them with treble ceremony." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 6 through 8. Just then, a carriage wheels up bearing the near-lifeless bodies of Palamon and Arcite, who, in Theseus's admiring recounting, fought with nearly superhuman bravery, declaring that, quote unquote, "their lives concern us much more than Thebes is worth." Theseus orders that these two men be given the best possible assistance. Act 1, Scene 4, lines 32 through 33. A medical miracle, he suggests, may yet be possible. "This world's a city full of straying streets, and death's the marketplace where each one meets." The three widowed queens say goodbye to one another, observing the proper funeral rites and marking the necessity of death for all human beings in due time. In Act 1, Scene 5, the funeral rites of the three queens' dead husbands take place, and the women lament with one poignant line running, quote unquote, "our dole more deadly looks than dying." Act 1, Scene 5, line 3. The queens may be suggesting here that their rites' styled acts heighten the reality of death, lending mortality more dignity than it would otherwise have. The first queen acknowledges the universality of death, saying, quote unquote, "heavens lend a thousand differing ways to one sure end." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 13 through 14. To this, the third queen adds that, quote unquote, "this world's a city full of straying streets, and death's the marketplace where each one meets." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 15 through 16. This is the tragic consciousness of the ancients speaking in somewhat updated form. As Northrop Frye writes in Fools of Time, Studies in Shakespearean Tragedy, quote unquote, "in the tragic vision, death, ellipsis, gives shape and form to life." Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Wednesday, December 3rd, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition four-volume genre-based format.